not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
And hello, folks. Welcome to Be the Media. You're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. I'm Marianne Vanderzon, and I'm here in the studio with a number of guests, and we've got a great show lined up. First up, we have Andrew Jeglom. He's a graphic designer and a student at Vancouver Island University. He works in several different media and joins us to discuss an audio piece he recently created called Broken Printer. Then, Tanu Huff is a student studying digital media at Vancouver Island University. He joins us to discuss an audio soundscape he recorded and produced this past summer. It is called Welcome to Gulu. Tanu recorded the audio for this piece during his time in Gulu, Uganda, during this summer. Finally, on Be the Media, we have Books and Bites. Joy Googler revisits a presentation by Australian poet Jeff Goodfellow, who spoke to VIU creative writing students earlier this fall. Goodfellow is a throat cancer survivor after being a heavy smoker and is Adelaide's people's poet, delivering readings on construction sites, in jails, and in working class suburbs. And so, folks, we're going to jump right into our first interview with Andrew Jeglom. And before I say welcome to him, I just want to let you know a little bit about him. He's a longtime resident of Nanaimo, currently studying at VIU, who enjoys creative pursuits within and outside of his day job as a graphic designer. He works in several media, and this past year featured a series of pieces which included design work, illustration, and video at his first art show held at the Electric Umbrella Gallery. Andrew, welcome.
Hi.
Andrew, you're a graphic design student at VIU, and so this piece, you're here to talk specifically about an audio piece that you did, and this was done for an audio class, Digi 270, that you're currently taking. And so let's start off. What was the inspiration for the piece?
Well, initially I took the class just to help me get more acquainted with audio recording and whatnot, and I've always been really interested in electronic and in like very unorganic arrangements of real world organic sounds. And due to the nature of the assignment, it was very open. Go out and collect some real world sound recordings and whatnot and make something out of it. It kind of just gave me an excuse to make my own piece and kind of interpret, I guess, drawn a couple influences of various artists that I listen to a lot.
So, for example, who?
For this piece in particular, there's an artist called Alvin Noto, who recently, he's got a series of these albums out, but they're called Xerox, and they're basically titled Xerox Volume 1, 2, 3, etc. And he makes sounds out of, or he makes music out of, printer sounds, Xerox machines, industrial equipment, that kind of thing. So I thought it would be kind of an interesting limitation to, or a confine to work within, I guess. So I went out and, I have three printers in my house, and, a couple of them are broken, don't work so well, and, basically, they lend themselves to, or they have a lot of interesting sounds when you can cut them up and recompose them and, make different interesting kind of arrangements out of them. So that's what I did with this project. I sampled a couple printers and basically tried to make a song out of them.
Beautiful. Before we jump in further, let's listen to the piece. People can have a listen and get a sense of what you're talking about. I think you set it up well there. And then we'll continue on. Now, I've been, for myself, been calling this piece Broken Printer. Do you have, is that the title or do you have another title in mind?
Whenever I title like anything I'm working on, whether it be like a design project or anything like that, I always just punch in the first thing that comes to mind when I'm saving the document. So Broken Printer was certainly the most appropriate thing to title this piece. So that's that.
Folks, here we go. This is Broken Printer by Andrew Jeglom. Folks, that is Broken Printer by Andrew Jeglom. So, Andrew, I mean, obviously, that piece is very musical and very funky. It just keeps making me want to groove. And so it's, but it's innovative, too. And I wonder, I know that you did it for a class, for Digi270, but when you were creating it, well, first up, were you thinking about audience?
Not necessarily. I honestly had no idea what it was going to be, how it was going to turn out when I started the project, and that's largely because I'm pretty inexperienced when it comes to doing audio and all that. But I mean, the reception so far has been nice. People in class liked it and everything like that, which was pretty cool. So yeah, that's encouraging at least.
And so you said you didn't have a particular idea. So can I take it then from that you didn't have a particular plan in terms of what you wanted to do with the piece? You know, in terms of informing or?
Yeah, the structure. I wasn't following any kind of like verse chorus or anything like that. I guess if anything, I knew from the beginning that it was just going to be a series of sounds that built to a kind of eventual climax. When I was making the piece, I initially made what did I do? There were a lot of sounds that I didn't use for this. I did a lot of experimentation in terms of cutting things up and rearranging them and pitch bending and this and that and the other thing. Yeah, basically I just took all of my favorite arrangements and then arranged them into what that eventually was. So yeah, that's how that happened.
And then once you had the sounds collected that you wanted to use, then that's when you started to layer up and find particular grooves, I guess, to build on?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you were using Audacity for this?
Yeah, but with that said, I think I've used Audacity for two projects now, and I'm starting to run into some limitations with it, I think. And I've been talking to people and whatnot, and I think it's time to maybe try something new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Audacity is a great place to start, but when you're working particularly on complex things and also musical elements in terms that have tempos and beats, and that there are other programs, you know, many of them, Pro Tools and Logic and mm-hmm. beyond, that certainly are set up much better for that kind of work. So
definitely.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, though. Like, as soon as I'm getting acquainted with this program, I'm kind of starting to realize the limitations of it.
True, but in terms of DAWs, digital audio workstations, mm-hmm. when you move from one to another, the learning curve is very quick because they all work in the same way.
Right.
So I think that you'll find that the learning curve as you move to get to another program, it'll be fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're working with technology in terms of this, and I mean, it's very, you know, fitting for our times. And I guess I wondered, did you, when you came up with the concept, and you talked about your inspiration for it a little bit, when you came up with the concept, were you thinking about our use of technology? And I mean, as soon as I hear printers and I think about technology, I think about things like the designed obsolescence of printers, that they, you know, they tend to break down quickly, for example.
Right. It wasn't necessarily something that I was considering when I was making the piece or when I was setting that limitation on myself that, you know, I could only use printers. but I remember back in the day, one of my first jobs when I was 17 was working at Staples, and I sold printers and everything like that and computers and all that, but printers, bar none, were like the one thing that people always had issues with. People just hate printers for some reason because they, you know, they break down so quickly. So maybe that had some kind of subconscious influence on me when I was making the piece. I don't know.
You wanted to repurpose the printer so people could dance to it instead of getting frustrated by it.
I guess so. That's a nice kind of thought, I guess.
Any future hopes for this piece? Any intentions to put it out into the world a little further?
I don't know. I'm honestly interested in pursuing different audio projects, because this was kind of my, you know, first foray into composing something like this. Yeah, now that, as I said, as I'm getting more kind of acquainted with recording techniques and the software and everything like that, I think I'm interested to do a few other things before I do anything else with this one.
Well, fair enough. Well, you did a fantastic job, especially, you know, as you mentioned, for your first piece.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So, Drew, you also do a lot of other work, a lot of other artistic work. And as I mentioned off the top, that you were involved in an art show this past year. It was February in 2012 at the Electric Umbrella Gallery. And I know it featured many of your pieces, and they included everything from your design work to your illustration and video work. So quite, you know, roaming and, you know, in a lot of different directions. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. What was that?
Well, it was kind of funny how that started, because to give you a little bit of background, every year I have an annual Christmas party, just this awful house wrecker of a party. And last year I thought it would be kind of fun to market it as if it were an actual event. And so I kind of started making like a little advent calendar of posters that I would post on Facebook, like, you know, every day leading up to the thing. And my friend Russ, who I didn't know at the time, who owns the gallery, which is also, it's a tattoo shop/gallery. He sent me a message on there and said basically like, blah, 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 I really like what you're doing with these pieces. And I thought that was kind of funny that some random person found me on Facebook and got a kick out of this thing that I was initially doing as kind of just like a joke for fun sort of a thing. So I thought, basically he offered me a time in February to show all these pieces and everything like that. And I took him up on it. And as a result of that, I kind of started going a bit overboard with it and made a couple like shows, like Rock Band style posters for it, large scale things, and a video piece as well. And in the show, I kind of documented all of my process in terms of like various logos that I tried out for it and things like that as well. So it was just kind of a big for fun thing that kind of happened by accident, but was, you know, fun regardless. And I feel like I should just mention that Russ is actually having his one-year anniversary show of opening his gallery this Saturday. And that's going to feature all of his personal work and whatnot. So go check that out.
Where is the gallery, Drew?
It's in Old City Quarter, and it's called The Electric Umbrella.
Okay. And so, folks, that's this Saturday. And do you happen to know the time?
Yeah, 8 till 11, I believe. If you show up sometime around then, it'll be going.
Beautiful. Well, and just to finish off, perhaps, of that, the Electric Umbrella Gallery exhibition that you did, just tell us about one piece. Pull one piece out and show us in words what it was like.
They all kind of, like I said, I did kind of like an advent calendar poster series. And basically each one featured some kind of grotesque photograph with the logo of the party over top of it. And then the video piece was kind of like a compilation of that, all these photographs and then some video elements and stuff like that as well.
If anybody wants to check out your work, can they find it online somewhere?
Yeah, if you just look me up on Facebook, all the profile pictures and all that are still there, so...
And Andrew Jeglum, J-E-G-L-U-M. Beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm speaking to Andrew Jeglum, and we've been talking about his piece, Broken Printer, and we heard it a little earlier. If you missed it, you can always catch it on the podcast as of tomorrow. And just to take us out, we've got a track from Eamon Tobin, and it's off the album Foley Room, and this track is called Keep Your Distance. Folks, you are listening to Be the Media here on CHLY 101.7 FM, and we now have in the studio with us Tanu Huff. And Tanu Huff is a 20-year-old digital media studies student. He's widely traveled, and as he's traveled around the world, he's always heard music in his surroundings. He feels that music can connect us to a place, a situation, or an experience. Tanu, welcome.
Thank you.
Tanu, it's a pleasure to have you here. I know you spent the summer in Gulu, Uganda, and, you know, the piece that we're going to hear shortly and talk about, it comes very much from that experience. So just tell us a little bit about being in Gulu, Uganda, and how that trip came about, how long you were there for, that kind of thing.
Well, the first time I went to Uganda was actually right before my grade 12 year. I went with my mom, and she's a doctor, so we did lots of...
doctor's things as well as working in an orphanage. And ever since then, I just have had a passion to go back. And so last year, I was going to university in Montreal at Concordia. And so Concordia has a program where they take students, 20 students per summer to Uganda for 2 months. And so I went with them. I was helping with a documentary to raise awareness on AIDS as well as erase the stigma that AIDS has. And I was also working in an orphanage, so you'll hear a lot of children and laughing and things like that because of that.
Right, right. And, you know, so obviously while you were there during the summer, you did a lot of sound recording at the time.
I've recently, actually right before I went to Uganda for the second time where this piece takes place, I realized that I didn't really know that you could so amazingly record with a I didn't know how advanced portable recorders were, I guess. And so once I kind of clicked in on that, I bought one right away. Mm-hmm. I wasn't bringing a camera to Uganda, so I just thought I want to somehow record my trip in another way for myself. And then as I was there, I started to realize how much of a passion I actually have in recording natural sounds
Fabulous. So, and when you were recording, were you already thinking that you might do something with these recordings, or were they very much for your own personal memories and nostalgia purposes?
Both, definitely. As soon as I started recording, I started to realize the potential in looking back and looking for my most favorite recordings and using them to get it for myself and for creating pieces. And
Okay, so this all leads us to your piece, Welcome to Gulu. So I think the inspiration for it is clear. Is there anything that you wanted to add to that?
The piece basically just has three themes. The first one is environment, and the second is the culture, and the third is the new friendships that I encountered while being in Gulu.
Beautiful. Folks, this is a piece from Tanu Huff, and it's called Welcome to Gulu. We'll come back afterwards and we'll chat a little bit more about it.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, give me power.
A holy night tonight.
All this world.
Tune to it.
Fall on your knees. Oh, yeah, is for us. China Ningang,
his car and drives away far from all the things they are. Puts on a smile and spying all the night. Oh, he says bye 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 to all of noise.
Folks, welcome back to Be the Media. You're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo, and I'm talking to Tanu Huff, the creator of the piece you just heard called Welcome to Gulu. So Tanu, it's a beautiful piece. You created a soundscape that's really effective in bringing us, or me anyway, the listener, you know, on a journey. And for myself, having never traveled in anywhere in Africa, and not in Uganda either, it nevertheless, you know, makes me feel like I'm there and like I'm present. And there's a real intimacy to your piece that's very compelling. So just, you know, you've done a nice job with it.
Makes me so happy to hear. And that's exactly what I was trying to do, was to try to just bring people's imagination to the fullest and imagine and what it could be like or would be like. That's exactly what I was trying to do.
Cool. And is that, I mean, so why soundscape? Is that why you chose soundscape? Because typically soundscape, for those listening that don't know, soundscape is about recording the sounds around you in a particular environment and then editing them in a particular way. And Tanu, I know that you did a lot of editing, because we were talking off air. You said you had 50, 60 hours of audio that has then been brought down into this 5.5 minute piece. Mm-hmm. It's a tremendous amount of work that goes into that.
Yeah, definitely. And most of the work basically is the hours upon hours of footage sound recording I just have to go through to pick out which parts I then want to use. certainly the mixing part took a very long time too, but just to go through everything takes hours and on hours.
And how did you pick? I mean, you said before we heard the piece, you said you had three themes. It was friends, children. What was the third one?
Just the culture.
And the culture itself. So when you started to already pull your clips, did you have those three themes in mind, and did you use them then as anchors, so to speak?
I didn't. I just wanted to go through everything with an open mind and just pick out all of my favorite parts, and then just sort of then after knowing about our audio project, that's when I started to really think about what I wanted to get out across with this project.
Okay, so 50 hours of audio and you brought it down to 5 minutes. So how did you pick your clips?
Like I said, I just went through them all and just thought about which ones I thought the audience could really relate to as far as getting brought to another place.
Okay, so you did have audience in mind then when you were creating the piece?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And did you have a particular intention? I mean, were you wanting to entertain your audience, inform your audience? What was your intention?
I was to educate or just to bring awareness to an experience like this, and just about how magical and amazing there can be. I mean, like, there's just so many perspectives and ways of life in this world to explore and to embrace. And I feel that the audience can partly embrace an experience like that through hearing something like this.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think it does, you know, and I think particularly with radio, one of the advantages is that there's a lot of room for imagination. So it allows us to have that sense that as though we're there on the ground, and some of the visuals, they come into our minds then.
Exactly. You're not being told what to do. I almost feel like through video, you're almost being told what to do, or what your brain is being told what to decode instead of your imagination taking over. And Yeah,
I wanted to come back to this idea of the genre of soundscape, I guess, because, you know, you could have done this piece with a narrative over top. You know, it could have been your voice or someone else's that kind of brought us through a very specific journey. But instead, you chose to work with soundscape. And as I mentioned, you know, this genre of taking field recordings and you know, I think you very effectively created a journey for us. And what is it that draws you to soundscape?
Throughout my whole life, I feel like I've heard music in odd things. I remember this weird memory of just jamming to the windshield wipers going back and forth for a 6-hour bus ride. Yeah.
It's natural to you.
Yeah. I feel like digital media nowadays, and especially with the amazing things that you can do with digital audio workstations and just with portable recorders, it's just... this new age is really perfect for me.
Well, one of the things I like about soundscape is I always feel like it slows me down. You know, instead of being in that place of rushing to the next thing, there's something about getting immersed in a soundscape that slows things down, and I really appreciate that. Do you find that as well?
Definitely appreciate that. I feel that if you just close your eyes and listen, sometimes you can just be brought to a place and feel emotional about a place, or feel emotional about a thought that you can't in any other, can't through video and can't through seeing, or in my opinion, sound is above all of the senses, an amazing way to receive information.
So it sounds like you're quite passionate about it. I know that you are shortly off to Costa Rica in January. Off you go again.
Yeah.
And are you going to be recording again?
I am 100% going to be recording. I've nonstop been recording, even just like with my friends, with funny things that we do. I'm kind of like, I just put the recorder on sometimes and then go through it later and find some funny things that have happened and keep them for later use of whatever projects come later.
Beautiful. A collector of sounds.
Yeah.
Tanu, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Folks, I've been speaking with Tanu Huff, and he is the creator and producer of Welcome to Gulu, the piece that we just heard. I also want to remind you that you can catch any of our podcasts. We have 109 now, and you can find them on our website, bethemedia.ca. You can also like us on our Facebook page, and that is, of course, facebook.com/bethemedia. You can catch us on Twitter as well, at bethemediaradio. And we'd love to hear from you. We're always up for ideas in terms of interviews and suggestions and such, so please send us out your ideas. Next up, we have Jeff Goodfellow, a poet who Joy Googler spoke with for the purposes of Books and Bites. We'll be right back.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. First you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
Folks, this week on Books and Bites, Joy Googler revisits a presentation by Australian poet Jeff Goodfellow, who spoke to VIU creative writing students earlier this fall. Goodfellow is a throat cancer survivor after being a heavy smoker and is Adelaide's people's poet, delivering readings on construction sites, in jails, and in working-class suburbs. He's been a writer in residence at Penn State and York Universities, is the author of My Bout with Jack Dancer, No Collars, No Cuffs, Bow Tie and Tails, No Ticket, No Start, Triggers, Sex Poems Unleashed, Semi-Madness, Poems for a Dead Father, and Punch On, Punch Off, and has been featured in Best Australian Poems of 2011. He writes a poem each Saturday for the Melbourne Age. But don't take our word for it. He'll tell you his story in his own words, all of them a unique brogue with poetry and force.
Been a poet. I left school at 15. I never passed year 10. I went to work as a butcher, truck driver, oil rig worker, steel fixer, dug trenches, worked down the wool stores, bounced in hotels and nightclubs, trained professional boxers, did a wide range of different work, physical work, semi-skilled work. And like most young people, I thought that I was invincible. I thought I'd do those things for the rest of my life. However, at 32 years of age, I ruptured a couple of discs in my spine, crippled myself and spent a good deal of time in traction. I'd grown up in the inner northern suburbs of Adelaide in very much a working class environment. All of our fathers had been to the Second World War. They were all alcoholics. It's a street full of alcoholic men and fathers that went to work doing fairly simple jobs. They were builders, labourers, truck drivers, bus drivers, mail sorters, welders, carpenters, picture frame makers, just knockabout people. No one read. There were no books in any of the houses in the street that I grew up in. I went to a all-boys technical high school where I was expelled. I'd never been shown any books that vaguely resembled the lifestyle that I lived in the inner northern suburbs of Adelaide. They tried to make me read Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice, and I couldn't understand what it was about after about seven pages. The teaching quality was so poor that I gave up on that idea, and I never ever saw myself as a poet. I wasn't a reader. I hadn't grown up illiterate. I knew how to read. I read the newspaper every day, of course. Poetry, that's for girls. I'm too tough to read poetry. Then I thought, well, no one will see me. I'll read it. I read it from cover to cover. After reading it once, I thought, I'll read this again. I read it again, and I thought, I reckon I could write this sort of stuff myself. I grabbed a pad and a pen, and I started to write. If I look back on that stuff, it was fairly dreadful poetry. It's all rhyming verse, because I thought, you know, with my limited education, the poetry had to rhyme. I knew Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Silly Jill forgot the pill and now she's got a daughter. So I knew all the nursery rhymes and I thought, well, I'll have a crack at this writing. So I filled up this book of dreadful rhyming verse about poor old Jeff with his broken back, and I had no one to show it to. I showed it to my brother, who was the most highly educated now in our family. He said, well, you should see if you can get in a book. And I didn't have a clue how to do that. I didn't know who to go to, who to ask, but I went to a library and I borrowed a heap of books of poetry from the library. Took them home, read through them, and most of the books stunk. They'd been sitting in the library for 100 years. They were written by people in another era to me. The language wasn't mine and I couldn't understand what the poetry was about, and I thought, I'll give the idea away of being a poet. And then I thought, don't roll over so quick. Go to a bookshop, you might be able to buy some contemporary books. So I went and bought a couple of books of poetry, took them home, started to read them, and the thing that struck me more than anything was the poetry didn't rhyme. It was free verse poetry. Initially I had great difficulty in seeing that as being valid poetry, but the more I read it, the more I thought, yeah, this works. And I thought, well, I'll have a crack at writing a poem in free verse. So my first poem in free verse was written in spring of 1983. It was published in a small literary journal in Adelaide. In 1984, I went to university for a year as a mature age student. I got 7 distinctions out of the 9 subjects. Worked out I really wasn't as silly as I looked, and I thought that I don't really want to be an academic. What I want to do is write poetry. So my first book, No Cuffs, came out in 1986 at Adelaide Writers' Week, and that's been through 9 printings, which makes it one of the best-selling books of poetry in Australia today. Bowtie and Tails in 88 is in a 4th printing. No Ticket, No Start is a slim volume. In 1990, I stopped work on every major building and construction site in Australia and read poetry to building workers. Not just read poetry to them, but also wrote poems about them. And this book sold 5,000 copies in 7 months and went into an immediate reprint of another 2,500. But it sold to people who are on the cover of the book, to builders, labourers, concrete finishers, steel fixers, plumbers, electricians, people who might ordinarily have thought that poetry was for an effeminate culture. Triggers, the next book, is a textbook that shows how to write poetry the Jeff Goodfellow way, and there is no one right way or one correct way. Of course, there are many ways, but that's the way that I do it. It's worked for me and it's worked for a good many other people, and that's gone through 4 editions. Then came Semi-Madness, Voices from Semaphore. Semaphore is a suburb I live in. It's a beachside suburb next to Port Adelaide. I took my first bride to Semaphore when I was aged 18. I've taken many brides there since, and the book changes covers as I change brides. Then came a small book called The Sex Poems Unleashed, a small pocket-sized book, and these are poems that I read in the early 90s at late-night venues, nightclubs in Adelaide, where I'd jump on stage at 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning and try and rev people up before they went home. My next book, Love is Cruel, are poems about love, sex and relationships. One of the poems from this book was set on the syllabus in Tasmania for the high school certificate. Then came Poems for a Dead Father, poems about growing up with an alcoholic father in a dysfunctional family in the inner northern suburbs of Adelaide. This book was shortlisted for the Age Book of the Year Award. Then came Punch On, Punch Off, poems about work and workers, poems about people who are employed, unemployed and underemployed. And in 2007, I worked with a band called the Robot Sex Dolls, and we put out a CD of spoken word with the Love is Cruel poems behind it, and we recorded my voice in December of 2007. But on the 1st of February 2008, I was diagnosed with cancer of the throat. I was told I had 1 to 5 years to live. Shortly thereafter, after I had my voice box removed on the left-hand side, and I'm speaking to you today through a synthetic voice box that's been lodged inside my throat. What I did then, though, was lay around in bed, refusing to die, and put out the new book, Waltzing with Jack Dancer. And a waltz is a slow dance. Slow dancer you're turning in circles with, and Jack Dancer, of course, is cancer, and I was turning in circles with cancer, not sure whether I was going to live or die. Photographs as well as poems, so I was photographed right through the procedure, just in case I didn't make it through, my kids would then have some record. This poem has been also used as a piece of public art in South Australia. A poem has been mounted on the wall of the Supreme Court, and it has been published this year in the Best Australian Poems for 2011. It's called An Uncertain Future. I was sitting in my car opposite the Adelaide Magistrates Court, waiting on a change of lights when I first saw her. She was in her early 20s, had on a black sleeveless top and a denim miniskirt. Her arms and legs were heavily tanned, and she wore strappy sandals. Her hair was bottle blonde, and as she crossed in front of me, blowing out a stream of blue cigarette smoke, I noticed her black roots complemented her chipped and broken front teeth. She was at least 7 months pregnant. The lights changed. I moved off slowly into my own uncertain future. I grew up in an Australia that was saturated with advertising for tobacco products, and by the time you got page 3 of the daily newspaper, there'd be a full-page ad for Rothmans, and page 5 would be a full-page ad for Craven A, and the next page would be a full-page ad for Benson and Hedges, and the cigarette advertising went on. You'd turn on the black and white TV in the early 1960s when television arrived in Australia, and there was a little penguin used to come across the screen and say, smoke cool, and cool cigarettes were spelled K-O-O-L, and, you know, I was about 13 years of age, and I thought, well, that's a cool way to spell cool. I'll go and buy a packet of cool and try them out. And in those days, you know, you could buy cigarettes at any age. You know, you just went out for my parents, and bingo, you had them. And they were cheap. They were 25 cents a packet. And I thought about the branding of cigarettes and went home and wrote this poem called Maybe. People say that poetry is difficult to market, poetry is difficult to sell, that no one makes any money out of poetry. Well, to that I say bullshit. You just have to be a lateral thinker. I sold this poem to the anti-smoking campaign in Adelaide for $2,500, and I don't think there'd be too many poems in Adelaide that have pulled $2,500. I sold it to them on a one-use-only contract. If they want to use the poem again, they have to come back and negotiate, and next time it'll be more expensive. Here's the poem. It's called Maybe. In the head and neck ward, most of us blokes are 50 plus, old Marlborough men, on alpine white beds. Now that's cool, and I'll give you the drum. It could be Winfield Reds on the right and Blues on the left. Geez, that looks like Blue in bed 7. Hasn't he lost some weight? And where is Paul Hogan when we really need a laugh? Post-op now with stapled throats after our neck dissections. Maybe it'll hurt too much. Maybe there's nothing much to laugh at anymore. Maybe now the laugh's on us. The war on drugs has been going on for 30 years too. Neither of those wars have been won. Both of those wars take their share of casualties. Of course, the people that die from a drug overdose and a lot of the heroin, most of the heroin that comes into Australia would come in from Afghanistan. And we don't talk about those sorts of things because it's unpalatable, and because most people, I think, assume that junkies are a shitbag culture and that they're no good anyway. And I was thinking too how the language of war and the language of junkies is very much in parallel. A lot of the terms that are used within both of those subcultures are in parallel, and I wrote this poem called Collateral Damage. When I think about the war and Afghanistan and collateral damage, I think about Mark and his weakness or love or his perceived lack of it. And still I count him as a casualty, shooting away madly for over 20 years, his teeth ground down to blackened stumps. He is forever wounded, as he wounds too. And the battle rages as he seeks that easy target. There's no white flag. His sights are set. The score ever so important. This poem is called The Game. I was born in Adelaide in the first half of the last century, when Ireland was 6 weeks away by ship and the northern suburbs finished inside Grand Junction Road, when going down south meant Dore Park or Darlington. I grew up when the SANFL ran our footy, when the game was played on your local oval by local blokes. I grew up watching Ken Eustace rove around the oval in a Guernsey on a Saturday and around his car yard on Main North Road in a t-shirt from Monday to Friday. Now the AFL runs a game and it's likely to be played any day or night of the week. And regardless of what position you play or who you play for or where you come from, you won't step out in public on game day without a suit and tie. I grew up when ice was covered in Hessian sacks and hauled from a horse and cart for delivery door to door. When it was lug dripping up driveways in metal clamps and in through your back door to a zinc-lined chest to refrigerate your food. Now ice is cooked up in backyard kitchens by opportunists quick to score and earn. And though it might be called ice, it can just as easily be called speed or crystal meth, and can be injected, snorted or smoked. depending if you're looking for a rush. And though the old home delivery may still be an option, these days you might be more in tune listening for a Harley rather than a horse and cart. I was raised a rifle shot away from the Islington Railway Workshops and the Reapham Hotel, where 5,000 people punched on for work every morning, and where they might likely punch on of a pay night on Thursday night. Now the workshops are full of spiders and cobwebs. The Reapham's full of pokies and pensioners. And you can see the second generation unemployed buying their baked beans and white sliced bread at nearby North Park Shopping Centre. I was told as a boy the Australian Labor Party represented me and my family. Only now they've adopted an American spelling. And it seems they resent me and my family. And we don't know where the hell to turn. I grew up with a choice of an 8 o'clock or a 10 o'clock mass on a Sunday, where about 300 people poked out their tongues for their host, where the parish priest spoke to a live audience in a dead language. And the only thing I truly understood was that I remembered most of those faces around me from the fish shop lineup on a Friday night. I grew up signing for my wages in sterling currency in a yellow envelope on a Thursday night, when the boss spoke to me in a dignified voice and urged me to work over and above my 40 hours. Now it's all direct debit and plastic cards, and you're lucky if you've got a full-time job. 70% of our workforce is casual, and some will have three or four jobs. Yet each and every one has got a mobile phone through necessity, so they can be summoned by the boss at his or her command, and in the meantime, pay a dollar a minute when they have to make a call. I grew up when full employment meant 6% were unemployed, and though both major parties try to claim that now, the fact is that if you've worked an hour through a week, it's considered you are gainfully employed, and though we might not have work choices under Labor, there's still little choice of work, and the Liberals talk of raising the retirement age to 70 and cancelling out the dole. I think we've lost the game. I worked on building sites giving readings to building workers, and building workers are people that use language all the time. They're talking all the time through their working lives, and they're men that are generally fairly well built. They're confident, you know, they've punched on a bit in pubs on a Thursday or a Friday night. They know who they are. I like working on building sites reading poetry because I was given a hard time by the press, and I'd go onto building sites to do a reading, and I'd be dressed in a pair of steel cap boots and jeans and a blue singlet, and I'd go up in a elevator to the 34th level of a building that was under construction to do a reading, and be some union official that was 6'4" that was happy to carry my bags. People would think that I was a worker too, and they'd be talking about how they're going to give this poofed poet a bit of a wind-up. And Australians love to heckle, but I could shut them up pretty quick, and I did. And they really enjoyed the readings, they bought the books, and they wanted more.
Every day gets shorter, colder, and hand in hand we walk through leather fire. The mountains bleed red as the sun gets higher. All the things that you want, I'll provide to your footprint. Swept away by the tide, I can wait for a while. I don't mind, yeah, I can wait for a while, 'cause I got time. I wish it was less of the way it is. I wish it were more of the way it could be. And you can put your faith in me for a while. In the end, I hope you're free, 'cause I'll be out of style. All the things that you want, I'll provide to your footprint. You're swept away by the tide, and I can wait for a while. I don't mind, yeah, I can wait for a while. I got time, I got time. Whoever said you can't be saved by a song? Whoever said that was stringing you along? by the time that I can wait for a while. I don't mind, yeah, I can wait for a while. I got time and all the things you're looking for. I hope you'll find before your footprint is swept away by the time.
And folks, you're listening to Be the Media here on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. And that was Books and Bites, Joy Googler talking to Jeff Goodfellow. Folks, I just wanted to let you know before we sign off for today that there is a new story out of University of Toronto, the radio station there, CIUT 89.5. I just wanted to let you know that U of T, the radio station, is planning to sue the former general manager. And so if you want to find out about that, you can just simply Google U of T and, of course, CIUT, and you can find out more information. In essence, the radio station CIUT-FM has filed a lawsuit against former station manager Brian Burchell, seeking to retrieve more than $160,000 that were allegedly embezzled by Burchell in the lead-up to his firing in October in 2010. It's a radio station that's had quite a lot of drama in its lifetime. So, many thanks to all our contributors today on Be the Media, to Andrew Jeglom, Tanu Huff, Jeff Goodfellow, of course, Joy Googler, and I'm Marianne Vanderzon. Thanks for listening. Be the Media is brought to you by the Media Studies Department and the Media Research Lab at VIU.
How does that grab you?